Have you ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? When we come through, it's true magic. 'Cause we came to play at Walt Disney World Resort.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere. This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Releasing the Ego's Grip. In this podcast, Eckhart talks about the pitfalls of the ego and the need to feel superior. He explains, we seek an identity through external distinction, like wealth, fame, even our nationality, to dispel the anxiety that we're not enough. He says, the focus on image creates a false sense of self. He shares examples from his own life. He shares that growing up, his family struggled financially, which left him with low self-esteem. He asked why bad things always seem to happen to him. To bolster his feelings of inadequacy, Eckhart says, he pursued intellectual achievements, which came easily, but his sense of superiority soon vanished in the wake of his negative thinking. Eckhart says for a time, he sought refuge in complaining and victimhood. But after he experienced an awakening, the old patterns gave way to something greater, and his self-hate evaporated. He explains he finally understood the meaning of Buddha's teachings about suffering and the end of suffering, and how liberation emerges when we release the ego's grip.
A huge part of identity is collective. Let's say you derive your identity from your nationality or your nation. And there's nothing wrong with that. You can love your country. There's nothing wrong with that. But what about feeling superior through being a particular nationality? That is, the ego comes in there. We happen to be in America, but it could be in any country. Let's say, I'm American, it's obviously superior to everybody else. The implication, I'm just giving you an example here, in another country, I would say that nationality. Now imagine that the entire planet was American and everybody's American. You could no longer define your sense of self through being American. It's impossible because you haven't got the other anymore. The other has disappeared. The whole thing has become meaningless. I'm American, the other's me too. And what about, yeah, me too. In fact, it wouldn't only be that, the entire term American would not exist in the absence of the other, would disappear. If the entire world were blue, everything is blue, every human is blue, the word blue would not exist. You need the other. So the ego needs the other, and it defines itself through the other, and it needs a sense of superiority towards the other. I'm talking about this because some of you may still have remnants of that in your life. And so it's very helpful to know how it operates. So when it surfaces in your life, you can recognize it. And in the act of recognizing it, you become free. It's only when you are in the grip of the ego that you are a slave. You are possessed by, ultimately, the egoic mind without knowing it. You're possessed by the stream of thinking that goes through your head. And if you say, I think, that would not ultimately be true, because people who are completely identified with the stream of thinking, they don't think, because thinking, when you say I think, it implies volition. It implies that you have some kind of exercise, some kind of control over. But for many people, the thinking happens in their mind, and they have no choice in what thought comes into their mind. So it's not that they think, the thinking happens to them. They might say, I'm thinking about my problems, and I can't stop thinking about my life. And that it's just I can't stop. You are not thinking. The thinking happens to you. You're not doing it in the same way that you don't. You're not beating your heart. You can't say, I'm beating my heart. The heartbeat happens to you, and even breathing, you can stop it for a little while, but not for long. The breathing happens to you too. It takes place of its own accord. And in the same way, anybody who is completely identified to the stream of thinking is something that happens to you. It lives in you, pretends to be you. Whether the story of the me is predominantly of a personal kind, in which case you feel it's based on the image of possessions, it's based on abilities that you have but that others do not have, something you can do. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's a wonderful thing to cultivate skills, whatever it may be, to learn to play an instrument, to learn to write, to dance, many, many things. It's a wonderful thing to engage in acquiring new skills and new abilities. It's part of life. But the question is that being used unconsciously in a search for an enhanced sense of self, a stronger identity? In which case you always need the other who cannot do what you can do.
Have you ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? Step up like a boss and save the day? Or see what life's like under the Tree of Life? Did you? If you could, would you? When we come through, it's true magic. 'Cause we came to play. Bring the magic at Walt Disney World Resort.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
You want to be famous. Many egos want to be famous. And then feel, once I'm famous, then everything will be great. Once I just want to be famous. Now, again, in order to be famous, the implication is that there's millions of people who are not famous. You need millions of people to be not famous, because otherwise fame has no meaning. So when you say I want to be a celebrity, at the same time you're saying I want millions of people not to be a celebrity. It's amazing. Imagine let's go to some Twilight Zone place, and suddenly you wake up in a country where everybody is famous. Everybody is equally famous, which just means, of course, that everybody knows each other, and everyone says, oh, you are so great. And whoever you meet says, you are so great, and so are you. You are just wonderful. Now, that may sound quite nice, but to the ego, it's not satisfying at all. The whole thing would be meaningless to the ego. If everybody is famous, it means nothing anymore. Then you have to look for something else. So clothes, whatever it may be, some people pay little attention to the way they dress. For others, it's important. Not always the case of ego identification. They may just enjoy something lovely. But in other cases, it is unconsciously seeking for more of an identity, differentiates yourself from others. Some people dress in a weird way. Very weird clothes. And of course, your ego is saying, look at me, I'm a non-conformist. Look at you, you are all conformists. Look the way I, not me, I'm just example. Look the way I dress, which clearly shows that I'm superior to you because I'm a non-conformist. And so are my friends. All my friends are nonconformists too. We live together. again, it's a statement that gives you, you said you need, again, you need the other. The other is inferior one way or another. If the other is not inferior, the ego cannot survive. It's somewhat insane, but that's how it operates. Collective egos are huge in some countries or in some cultures more than others. In our Western civilization, the ego tends to be a bit more personal, their personal characteristic that you look for to enhance your sense of self. In other cultures, and of course older cultures, it was mainly collective, the collective identification with the tribe. You are a member of this tribe, and all the other tribes are less than human. Only we are the ones, whatever you call yourself, we are, the others are nothing. That's early manifestations of collective ego are like that. And in later times, nationalism and so on are expression of the same egoic dysfunction. So it's amazing once you recognize how and where the ego seeks superiority. In the past, in many countries, because we had a kind of, for a long time, we had a Yang civilization, a patriarchal society that only started to change around the 60s for Western civilization. And in some places, it's still very much Yang, where the man has more power than the woman. So any male that comes into this world, a significant part of his identity in those places is, I'm a man. The implication being, no matter how stupid you are, you're automatically superior to 50% of the population who are not a man. So that gives you your sense of, a huge chunk of your sense of self is you're a man. Again, a fiction in your mind. If everybody were a man, it would be meaningless. I had a struggle in my early life to find an identity. Well, many youngsters have, but of course my struggle was much more serious than other people's struggle. Much worse than yours. Youngsters look for, at an early age, look for an identity. You have the, for example, you see it in impoverished parts of big cities where you have gangs. After you have shelter and food, the next thing that humans look for is an identity. It's so important. It's a huge psychological need. So in parts of big cities, you have gangs. And you have tattoos that show what gang you belong to. And then they commit murder and often are murdered just for this identity, just to have an identity. I need to belong to this. That's something. And you desperately need the other who is not part of your gang. The way I see it is the ego is something that grows until you reach adulthood. And as you go into in an ideal world, and as you reach adulthood, you slowly begin to grow out of identification with a false sense of self, and then you grow into a deeper, and of course this is where we are going here tonight, we're on the way, you go into a deeper sense of identity that has nothing to do with a surface reality of the egoic sense of self. So that's where we are going. But unfortunately, in this world, still the majority of humans are stuck in the egoic consciousness to the end of their lives. But to a greater or lesser degree, the egoic consciousness varies in its intensity or density from person to person. Not every human has the same huge ego. Some egos are gigantic and other egos are a little bit smaller with small cracks into something deeper where the human being can relinquish temporarily their sense of self, their sense of the story of me, and temporarily they go, ah, wow, look at that sky. or you listen to some music, I mean real music, not the kind of thing they play in restaurants. You listen to some music and temporarily it liberates you, it gives you a taste while you listen, or while you might even play the music. While you play this music, temporarily you have a glimpse of the state of consciousness that we might call self-transcendence. And so it feels enormously wonderful in that state. It's not just the sounds that you are either listening to or producing and listening to. Yes, they have something to do with it, but what the sounds do is they temporarily cause the compulsive thinker to recede. A presence arises from within you, so the entire egoic identity temporarily recedes. You can sometimes see that when people listen to music or play music, and then there's a kind of a temporary transformation in them. They go, ah. It's a liberation. It's a temporary liberation from yourself. But usually it doesn't last. But it's good to have a glimpse of this self-transcendence. So we have the ego. As I said, I've had quite a struggle finding an identity. At first, the body couldn't be my identity because I had a not very strong body. So people made fun of me and I wasn't very strong, so I didn't move to Miami for that reason. And so my ego couldn't go do very much there, and it looked for something else. Now, my parents didn't have much money, so we didn't have more than anybody else. In fact, we had less than most people. So where would the ego go there? Can't do anything. I'm looking, where's my identity? Well, the first identity I found is the beginning of an unhappy and complaining me. That was the first beginning where I had a thought form, and whenever something bad happened in my family, which was always, there was always some drama going on, almost every other day something bad happened. So the thought in my mind was, of course, some bad things always happen to me. For several years, I had this persistent thought, bad things always happen to me. Of course, I knew it. I knew it wouldn't go. I knew we couldn't go on vacation because there's no money. And now here we are stuck at home. And then I had to lie and send it back to school. And they said, where did you go on your vacation? And I had to invent some place where we went because we didn't go anywhere. But I couldn't say, well, we couldn't afford to vacation. I couldn't say that. It's a desperate struggle for more of an identity. Until finally, when I reached age of 19, 20, I finally found that I can actually read books. I loved reading books. And I can acquire knowledge. And I become an intellectual. And if I become an intellectual, I'll be more knowledgeable than most people. I got it. I found. Now, that was the road to unhappiness too, unfortunately, because as I acquired more knowledge and then I showed off my knowledge, feeling very superior to others, and but strangely enough, together with that came a growing sense of depression and unhappiness. There was a false sense of self, and there was a continuous fear of not knowing enough, of not being enough, of others knowing more. And finally, I made it to university. And of course, there were always others who knew more than me. And then became more and more unhappy. So interesting how one looks. There's always a dissatisfaction that comes. Now, for many humans, I'm just in the last stage of explaining egoic identity and its various manifestations. For many humans, they desperately search for more of an identity, and If they can't find it, if you don't have more than others, you don't look better than others, you're not stronger than others, your abilities are not greater than other people's abilities, you don't know more than other people, so where are you? Where are you superior to others? Where? What does the ego do? Where does it find its sustenance? One simple thing it can do, it can continuously, in your either mentally or out aloud, it can complain. It complains about places, it complains about situations, it complains about other people, it complains about everything, in your mind or out aloud. Now, what is the implication when you complain? The implication when you complain is, let's say you're complaining about somebody, you know what he did? You would never ever guess what he did, and then he said this, and then I said that. He would always do that to me. He always does it. He's completely dishonest. And yes, stories, one story after another. But in every story, you complain about something or somebody. The implication being that you are superior, because you are the judge. You are judging this person as inferior. When you complain about a person, the implication is you are superior. When you complain about even a situation, you complain about a situation or a place, the implication, the unspoken implication is you're superior to that situation. You're just, this is how it is. I'll tell you how it is. That's how it's awful. Just look at that. Great. The ego can live on complaining alone, because you're always, by implication, superior to that which you're complaining about. So people are trapped in that. They don't know it. And so there may still be remnants in one or two of you of that mindset that loves complaining. And every complaint strengthens the fictitious sense of self. And then it loves enemies. The ego loves, connected with, these are connected, the ego loves to make other people into enemies, because you emphasize the otherness of others by treating them as an enemy. To define your fictitious sense of self, you need the other who is not what you are, who is less than you. The ego loves to emphasize the otherness of others and say, these people are my enemies. If whether you call them enemies or not, you do it. The ego does it on a personal level. You do it on a collective level, other countries.
Have you ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? Step up like a boss and save the day? Or see what life's like under the Tree of Life? Did you? If you could, would you? When we come through, it's true magic. 'Cause we came to play. Bring the magic at Walt Disney World Resort.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my world.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
This is a tendency to treat other countries as enemies. I can see it sometimes when I read the news, and you can see there's an unconscious collective mind pattern. The people don't even know what they're doing because they're in the grip of a collective mind pattern. They need to demonize another country. And they did it much more strongly, of course, in the first half of the 20th century. But even now, this pattern survives. You need to define yourself through the other. Okay, so we have emphasized the otherness of other by complaining or judging and so on, continuously gossiping, critical, being critical about people and situations, always find something that's wrong. When you find something that's wrong, you are far superior. You're pronouncing that this is wrong. I know. And if that doesn't work, a great one, and this is the last one I give as an example, if you don't know more than others, you don't have more than others, a great egoic identity is to see yourself as a victim of others. Wow, that's great. You are the victim, or a particular group that you belong to is a victim. Now, I'm not saying there have not been and are certain groups that have been victimized. That's true. But the question is, are you deriving your sense of identity from something that ultimately is just a fact that happens or has happened? This is a very common one, especially these days, because we have moved from a yang-dominated society into a more yin-dominated society, which was a wonderful and necessary thing. And that means humans have developed an empathy towards others that they didn't have before, an empathy with other human beings, an empathy with other groups of human beings, the disadvantaged, the poor, the marginalized, minorities. Because we moved from yang into yin, this compassion and empathy arose, which was a wonderful, wonderful and necessary thing. But anything can be used by the ego. The ego will get in there no matter what you do when you're not conscious enough. So because there is much more empathy, and which is a great thing, but you take it so much further, and more humans unconsciously realize that, oh, either I can derive very satisfying, well, not really, no egoic sense of identity is ultimately satisfying, but I can derive a strong sense of identity from considering myself being a victim. You have to be very careful with that, that you don't fall into that trap. It's very easy to fall into. So any victim identity, which can also arise through an illness, by the way, you can, if you have contracted a serious illness, in your mind, you form a mental image of me, the sufferer of this illness. I am, and that can become the main part of your fictitious identity. I'm the sufferer of this illness. Or if something bad has happened to you in the past, which bad things have happened to many of you, but are you deriving your identity from that? So basically, we've been talking about the bad news, which is the ego. And so where's the good news? The good news is that there is in you, in every human, but in most humans, it's still, majority of humans, it's still dormant, so to speak. There is the possibility of realizing a deeper dimension of consciousness than the egoic consciousness. That possibility is in every human, but is not realized in every human. But we could almost look at it as a seed that has not yet sprouted in many, many humans. And they are still stuck with it. In most of you, the seed of this new consciousness, or the transcendent consciousness, which is presence, has sprouted, with one or two exceptions. Some people didn't come here by their own free will. They were dragged here by somebody, and they're sitting there longing to get away. I shouldn't have, why did I, couldn't I say no? I should have said no. This man is insane, I don't want to. All the ancient teachings really point to this awakening, whether they call it, as the Buddha called it, this is the end of suffering, which really means it's the end of unhappiness, which is self-generated in your mind. Buddha defined his teaching as, he said, I show you suffering and the end of suffering. By saying that, he meant, I show you how suffering arises, and I show you how it can end. Suffering is the unhappiness in whatever form it manifests. And if unhappiness manifests in you in whatever form, you spread it. If you make yourself unhappy, you make others around you unhappy without even knowing it, because you make yourself unhappy without knowing it. You make others unhappy without knowing it. It becomes your reality. And it used to be the case that you make others unhappy in your immediate environment, but nowadays, because of the wonderful advances of technology, you can make others unhappy on the other part of the world, too. And they read your comments saying, Oh, yeah. So through the miracle of technology, the unconscious unhappiness can spread very, very quickly. And the toxicity of the egoic state of consciousness can very quickly engulf the entire planet. Wow, great achievement. So the Buddha said, I show you suffering and the end of suffering. Jesus talked about a strange term called salvation. Salvation is something, again, as I see it, it's the same thing, different word for the same thing. Jesus also talked about the kingdom of heaven. Be misinterpreted for 2,000 years because people think kingdom of heaven is where you go to when you die, or kingdom of heaven is something that eventually comes here and we just need to wait for it. Although Jesus clearly said, literally, I usually don't keep quotes in my mind, but I happen to remember this one. He clearly said, the kingdom of heaven does not come with signs to be perceived. You cannot say, oh, it's over there, or oh, it's over there. For I tell you, the kingdom of heaven is within you. So it's not an external thing that you can say, there it is. Because the kingdom of heaven is a state of consciousness that is possible for humans to realize. And I would like to change the way this term has been written about. Kingdom of heaven belongs to previous ages. In our modern world, it becomes more understandable if we rephrase the kingdom of heaven and call it, for kingdom, I suggest, dimension. It's the realm, it's the dimension. Heaven, what's heaven? Heaven is the vast sky. Heaven is the vastness. In many languages, sky and heaven are the same word. It's the vastness of the sky. So he talked about the dimension, and this heaven I translate as spaciousness, because the closest thing in this sense-perceived world that you can get to spaciousness, what is it? I mean, how do you find an analogy for spaciousness? The vast spaciousness of the sky. The dimension of spaciousness, the kingdom of heaven that is within you. So within you, there is a dimension of consciousness that is spacious. It is not cluttered. It is not full of the clutter of one thought after another. Continuous mental noise. That's not what it is. It is a dimension of inner spaciousness. So this is what he was pointing to. Another term the Buddha used, of course, is the term emptiness, which again, sunyata is one term in Sanskrit. Sunyata, emptiness. Again, I don't like that translation very much. Sunyata is spaciousness. Spaciousness. One of the main things the Buddha taught is spaciousness, inner spaciousness. So what is inner spaciousness? Inner spaciousness is here and now, in this moment, right here and now. You don't remember anything about your past or anything about your so-called future. Let's say what is left of you here and now, if you make no reference to the past, if you make no reference to the future, in fact, if you pretend that past and future don't exist. Is there anything left of you if you do not remember your past, not even your name, not even your email address? You don't remember your past and there's no future. Let's say you have no past and no future. What is left of you? And you have to be very alert to find the answer to that. You have to be very alert. There's no past, there's only this moment. And what is it? Are you still there? if you do not remember your past. In other words, if you don't think, are you still there? Is it possible for just a moment to not think without falling asleep? It is. It only needs to be maybe just a few seconds at first, not thinking, just a sense of inner spaciousness, a moment without thought. What remains when you relinquish thinking? An alertness remains, an awareness remains, a sense of beingness or presence remains that you cannot define in any way. A sense of I am, but you can't add anything to the I am. You just know your beingness. You know that you are. You can sense the beingness that you are. Perhaps you can even sense it with your entire body. Every cell of the body sense the beingness of you. That is the entry point in something, the deeper sense of beingness. I am. I call it, this is a term I didn't write in the books because it hadn't come to me at that point yet. This is a term that I now call the deep I. You have the surface I, when you say I need, I want, I love you, I hate you, I love myself, I hate myself, I don't like, I like. That's the surface I, the mind created. The deep I is the spacious I. The deep I is the realization of beingness, the realization that you are. But that you is very different from the surface you, the surface I, that has no history. That dimension of consciousness has no history. It has no time to it. It is what is called in spiritual literature eternity. Eternity meaning not endless time, but timelessness. Eternity is timeless. There is a deeper dimension of consciousness in every human. It is not yours. I might sometimes call it your dimension of, but it's not yours. When you enter this, the deeper dimension of consciousness in which you are not thinking, but you remain alert with no tension in it. There's no tension, just an alert presence. Maybe a little bit like the bird that goes shh, shh, shh. Just alert. That's the deep eye that connects you, that is one with something very profound that goes far beyond who you are as this temporary little entity, because you've come out of that temporarily as this being, the being of you, the being that incarnates temporarily and takes form as a human being with a name and a history, very short-lived. That being comes from a very deep, transcendent place, and it is ultimately the light of consciousness. All you know when you are not thinking about your past and your future, and in fact when you are not thinking, all that remains for you to know is that you are conscious. If you were not conscious, you wouldn't perceive all this. It's only in the light of consciousness that this is being perceived. And that's an amazing realization, because it could well be that you are dreaming this moment. There have been philosophers asking themselves over the centuries, is life ultimately a kind of dream? And you could look upon it as a dream. So let's say you're dreaming And you're dreaming that somebody is sitting up here on the stage on a chair and he's saying, you may be dreaming. Now, you can doubt everything. You can doubt everything except one thing, that you are conscious. Even if you are dreaming, there must be a consciousness in which the dream appears. That is the space for it. In the same way that this, what we perceive as external space allows everything to be. The most important thing about this room is not the things that are in the room, nor is it the floor, the ceilings, and the walls. That's not the essence of this room. The essence of this room is the spaciousness, the space. But you can't actually see it. You can't really say, show me where the space is. And then you go, oh no, it's here. Or it's everywhere. You can't even point at it. In the same way that you cannot point to the inner spaciousness. That's why Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven, which is a dimension of spaciousness, does not come with signs to be perceived. You cannot perceive it. Now, what is that consciousness? Science will tell you, if they ever even mention the word consciousness, in most cases they don't, because they don't know what to do with it, because you cannot find it under the microscope, and you cannot find it by cutting open somebody's head and examining the brain. They will not find consciousness, and they will not find you. They will not find a single thought, through no matter how powerful the microscope is. So there is something in you that far transcends anything in the physical realm. And of course, yes, science will still tell you consciousness is a byproduct of the physical brain. It's not. The physical brain is, yes, it can be compared to a transmitter of consciousness. It could be compared to a radio receiver that receives, let's say, beautiful music. But the radio doesn't produce the music, but it's necessary for the music to express itself in this dimension. And at some point, the radio will break down. Doesn't mean it's the end of the music. This is just an analogy. So there's undoubtedly a connection between the human brain and consciousness, but the human brain is not the physical brain, the chemical soup of the brain. It does not produce the miracle of this world, of even the miracles that humans have produced. Yes, they've been pretty insane in many ways, but there are also wonderful creations that happened through humans.
I'm Oprah Winfrey, and you've been listening to Eckhart Tolle, Essential Teachings, the podcast. You can follow these essential teachings on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you haven't yet, go to Spotify and follow this podcast. Join us next week for more enlightened teachings from Eckhart Tolle. Thank you for listening.